Now we go overseas. A free production from the Historical Society L'Astoria, Bremen, with volunteers from the United States. Part 2, Departure to Freedom, of 500 who set out to find and fight for human rights. Some of them have changed the country they settled in for the better.
Brüder, so kann's nicht gehen, lasst uns zusammen stehen, duldet's nicht mehr. Freiheit, ein Baum voll Dorn, jeder am Bette starb, beißt bald ins Hungerkram, folg ins Gewehr. Schlagt eure Plage tot, rettet das Land.
Brothers, it can't go on like this. Let's stand together. Don't tolerate it anymore. Freedom, your tree's rotting. Everyone's at the begging stick and will soon die of hunger. People to the gun. Brothers in gold and silk, brothers in peasant dress, reach out to each other. Germany's distress calls you all, as does Lord's commandment. Kill your tormentors, save the country. Kill your tormentors, save the country. Revolutionary Oberhessen, to the melody of God Save the King, Karl Fallen has written the lyrics of a freedom song. Karl was born in Romrod, Upper Hesse, in 1796, the son of a Gießen lawyer, Christoph Fallonius, and his wife, Rosina. The radical Democrat wants to change the country several times. In 1824, when he is to be arrested in Switzerland, he flees to America. His younger brother, the lawyer, Paul Fallonius from Gießen, and Paul's brother-in-law, the pastor Friedrich Munch from Niedergemünden, spread a request and declaration regarding a large-scale immigration from Germany to the North American Free States. Their note becomes the cornerstone of the Gießen Emigration Society. Fallonius and Munch want to live in freedom on American soil, together with like-minded Germans who can afford a fresh start.
We intend to unite all German emigrants into one large society, so that all grow in one and the same area.
Where we Germans can remain with German language and customs, where we can make our institutions ourselves by mutual agreement, support each other in the strongest possible way, and lead a free, peaceful and happy life under the protection of the government of the free states.
This is possible if all German emigrants settle in the same region, until, with the help of later and graduated growth of compatriots from the old homeland, also from individual states of the Union itself, a German free state, a rejuvenated Germany in North America can be formed, and German nationality can acquire a respected voice in the League of Nations.
Looking back, Friedrich Munch will write,
"The first colonies were to be joined by new ones every year until the necessary population was available to enter a new state into the Union. Since we were only too well aware of the political and social infirmities that had been fought in vain in the old world for so long, and since in the new world everything had to be done all over again, even if only innocent and liberal people were to be accepted into society, we hoped, albeit on a smaller scale, to establish a model German republic from which a beneficial repercussion could be expected even in the old fatherland. We were not merely counting on the participation of those who were already accustomed to harder work as farmers and craftsmen."
It is precisely the participation of the educated that is indispensable in order to ensure the necessary measure of intellectual training for the whole, for now, and for all future.
The revolutionary Friedrich Ludwig Weidig, a very popular scholar, rector from Butschbach, who is well connected throughout Europe and constantly monitored by authorities, is to join them. But Weidig refuses. A serious dispute ensues. In the view of Friedrich Ludwig Weidig, it is a betrayal of the social revolution, even of the fatherland, to leave when you are needed most. The members of the Gießen Emigration Society, however, see no future for themselves and their children in the Grand Duchy Hesse-Darmstadt. Munch and Philonius point out that they leave their homeland rather for political than for economic reasons. In 1876, the German Pioneer Association of Cincinnati, Ohio, published poems by Munch, also one from April 1834, which he wrote as a farewell of the old world.
"Changeful human life, who'd bear his fate if there was no hope? Hope shows us to rise the soul, peace and happiness in the distance. May time fly by. Hope shall revive the heart until the last moment."
What did Karl Schurz say, who participated in the March Revolution of 1848 and fled to the United States with his wife, Margareta, 4 years later?
"Ideals are like stars. We never reach them, but like the sailors on the sea, we set our course according to them."
The poet Hoffmann von Fallisleben, who wrote the lyrics of the German national anthem, spent a lot of time in exile as a champion of democracy, but did not choose the path across the Atlantic. "My temporary Texas is called Hulldorf," he once said. He saw friends and acquaintances moving far away and wrote a song about them in 1844, "Brothers, Let's Be Glad," it says. Subtitle, "Here at the Mississippi."
"Brothers, let's raise our glasses gladly, because we can live freely only abroad, can walk anywhere without a passport, meet daily without being harassed by police, here at the Mississippi. Neither free thinking nor free speech is taken here for a state crime. No gendarme here ever troubles us, and no one throws us in prison, here at the Mississippi. Titles, ranks, and social classes, and such stupid stuff comes to an end here. Here no priest may ever plague us with hell. Never a Jesuit will chase away our peace. Here at the Mississippi. In the past, we lived only as a punishment, as it were, and they sheared us like sheep. Brothers, let's sing, drink, dance. No one has the right to tell us what to do here at the Mississippi. Michel, don't continue to grow your seeds for the army of civil servants and for the soldiers. Michel, take heart to finally emigrate. Here you belong to yourself. There only always to the others, here at the Mississippi."
The interest in the Emigration Society is so great that they soon have to close the list. Passages for 500 people are ordered from the Bremen-based shipping company, Everhard and Friedrich Delius. On October 31, 1831, the first half travels with Philonius on the Ulbers via New Orleans. Munch leads the second group and is haunted by bad luck. The ship they want to take does not come. A second one is also canceled. And so the emigrants from Gießen are waiting on the Weser Island of Harjazand near Brakke for the things to continue. They have to share four rooms, a kitchen, a cow, and a horse stable, and sleep in the hayloft. In July 1834, those who still wanted to be there finally took the Medora to Baltimore. The passenger list includes adults and minors from Thuringia, Coburg, and Hesse, among others, including about 30 farmers, about 10 academics, and about 50 craftsmen, 6 maids, some women without a profession, and about 50 children, including Munch's 7-year-old daughter Pauline and his 6-year-old son Adolf, the children of his late wife Marianne Munch, née Bockert. One of the babies on board also belongs to the Munch family. It is the child of Friedrich's second wife, Luisa Munch, née Fritz. How did they fare upon arrival? The bookseller, Cornelius Schubert, a 21-year-old from Dessau, keeps a diary.
The first person who confronted us from the New World was the collector of the poll tax, which every immigrant has to pay with $1.50, and which is used to maintain a hospital for sick immigrants. After this collector had left us, the doctor appeared, who examined the health status of all travelers. The heat was unbearable, and had to be all the more so for us, as we had to endure so much cold just before.
Captain Griffith is in no hurry. He doesn't want to have his passengers' luggage brought ashore until the next morning. So the emigrants themselves lend a hand and carry the boxes off board. Baltimore's tax collectors are already waiting.
All things that are now good for one's own use are tax-free, including cloth and linen, books, and everything that promotes the arts and sciences. After an 8-day stay in this really beautiful city, I rented a freight wagon together with 2 families. We loaded our luggage onto it and drove out of the city. 2 women, a maid, and 6 children, all under 7 years of age, were on the wagon. We men walked in front, behind and next to the wagon, in order to be able to reach up and catch the often falling trifles. I'm loaded with a double-barreled shotgun, a deer catcher, and a hunting bag.
The freight wagons take 2 weeks to cross the Allegheny Mountains. The steamboat journey on the Ohio and Mississippi rivers to St. Louis take another 2 weeks. The journey was exhausting, especially for the youngest.
The children suffered from tormenting skin rashes, and after arrival I had to bury my youngest child, who gradually succumbed to the pernicious climatic influences.
The Gießen Emigration Society has gradually dissolved. The Munch family settled near Dessau in Warren County in a hilly landscape on the Missouri, not far from Paul Philonius and Gottfried Doden's farm. The lawyer and former justice of the peace from Rensselaer traveled to America as early as 1824 and campaigned massively for emigration after his return. His book, Report on a Journey to the Western States of North America and a Stay of Several Years on the Missouri River in the years 1824 to 1827, made many of his compatriots dream of a better life, from a land of milk and honey overseas with apple, pear, and cherry trees, wild vines, and hunting grounds that do not belong to any nobleman. If you have a rifle, you can go hunting, kill deer, turkeys, field chickens, pigeons, pheasants, or snipes.
One will not and cannot believe it in Europe, how easy and pleasant it is to live in this country. It sounds too strange, too fabulous. The belief in similar places on Earth had long been banished to the fairy tale world. The inhabitants of the Mississippi counties, on the other hand, consider the reports of the hardship in Europe to be exaggerated. That there are so many white people there who, with the greatest effort, hardly enjoy so much meat in a whole year as people feed to dogs here in a few weeks, that some families, without the mild donations of others, would even starve to death or freeze to death in winter. The citizens of the Missouri state, including their slaves, doubt so much that they are accustomed to relate such statements only to the intention of flattering praise of America.
The Giessen Emigration Society has sought advice from Doden, which Frederick Munch regrets in retrospect.
According to the description given by Doden, we had thought of the matter somewhat differently, namely in such a way that with the still unbroken natural abundance here, it would be sufficient to devote about half of our time to rough work, and that the other half would remain free for beautifying work, for further education and teaching of the children. But we found so much to do that we're hardly allowed to take a few free hours.
That's not how they had imagined it.
We were on a tight diet. Potatoes and other vegetables, even fruit, were not available at all, and hardly any bread and meat were available. We grinded the not yet fully ripe dried corn on graters we had brought with us, and from this flour the women tried to prepare various dishes with commendable inventiveness, while the hunting shotgun provided woodpeckers, squirrels, pigeons, and other game. This got better after we sowed and harvested ourselves. Now there was a whole army of German children and no school. I decided to teach several days a week for a very moderate salary.
In 1848, Georg Troy from Bamberg described the state of Missouri in this way in his guide for those willing to emigrate.
Missouri, size 66,973 miles, or 42,863,018 acres. Population, 383,702. The lowlands along the rivers are less healthy but fertile, producing cotton, rice, tobacco, corn, and cereals in abundance. But even the higher land contains large stretches of rich soil, which is not only suitable for the cultivation of ancient cereals, but also for cattle breeding because of the rich meadows. Some farmers own 200 to 300 head of cattle and 400 to 500 head of pigs. The country's wealth of usable metals and every kind of game is great, which means that it is not surpassed by any other part of the Union. The Missouri River and its numerous tributaries are the best place to sell the products. Trade and manufactories are already flourishing, and nowhere does the farmer lead a more pleasant and leisurely life than in this state. The most excellent cities are Jefferson City with 2,427 inhabitants, St. Louis with 25,810 inhabitants. The latter is already an important trading center.
Pauline Munch, who will marry Gaddy and Bush and have 13 children, remembers the early years in America.
When we arrived in America, my father bought a farm. but there was only a small field and a log house to live in. Everything else was forest. There was no close neighbors. The wilderness was still so great that you could hear the wolves howling in the evening. We children were very afraid then. How difficult the beginning must have been for my parents, who had lived completely differently in Germany. But thanks to my father's iron willpower, perseverance, and the constant industriousness of my mother, who worked from morning to night, we got through the first very hard years. At that time, we lacked any conveniences. All means of subsistence were expensive, and we had little opportunity to get or buy anything. Sometimes my father bought grain, but to turn it into flour, you had to load a sack full on the horse and ride it a long way to the mill. There was little wheat. For us, it was a feast when griddle cakes were baked. Fetching water was also difficult. It had to be carried up a long hill from a spring. How many buckets have I dragged up there in those years? But I was healthy and happy about it because I knew it had to be that way. We had little outside help in the first few years. The first winter was particularly hard for me, as the cabin was very leaky. It didn't even have a proper foundation floor, and we only had a fireplace for heating and cooking. In the evening, we moved the beds to the fire, where thick wooden logs had to burn all night. But there was a leak everywhere. When it stormed and snowed at night, there was snow on my blanket in the morning. The water that was brought in the morning to make coffee was frozen solid. The bread had to be baked in iron pots between coals because there was no cooking stove yet. We also had only a few pieces of furniture, and the immigrant boxes had to serve as our seats. We made our own shoes. Now, almost no one believes me anymore, but that's the way it was.
Paul Philonius died of typhus in 1844, 4 years after his brother Carl, who died in a steamship accident near Long Island. Paul's widow, Maria, who calls herself Mary in the United States, is almost destitute with her children. She writes to her sister-in-law, Luisa Volt Fallen, in exile in Switzerland.
How can I raise only the most necessary funds for the children's winter clothes? Julia does the hardest work in the snow and cold, but I had to leave her humble wish unfulfilled, since she has neither a coat nor anything of the kind, to buy a woolen dress for Sunday. My own body has been suffering steadily since last winter. I must not dwell on the thought of the situation in which we left you and Europe, and what we had to get used to, and what our situation is now. Nor do I want to complain to God, if only I see and know that we can continue to exist in a decent way, as we have done so far.
Continuing to exist with decency. For Friedrich Munch, this includes staying true to his ideals and going into politics in his new homeland. Although Munch, Philonius, and other men from the Gießen Emigration Society find it difficult to clear forests and work in the fields and are ridiculed as Latin farmers, they refrain from using slaves in agriculture. Owners of human beings is what the clergyman calls the slave owners, and more than once he and his family are threatened with death. But like his brother Georg, he has a female slave on the farm, registered in the Federal Census of 1850, who works in the household and looks after the growing number of children. It was the only way to get a helper, his daughter Pauline states in an undated letter to her aunt in Germany, where she herself is a housewife and has a slave as a maid.
It's been 2 years now since my husband brought a 13-year-old Negro girl. I was reluctant for so long, as I can't stand the thought that I would ever own a slave. I have always been disgusted by this trade. Yet what can you do when you live in a country where such a thing is allowed and you can't get help in any other way? One does such a girl a good deed if one does as we have, buying her from a hard master and treating her humanely. She has it as good as our own children. She has regular meals and clothing and is handled with care and love. And of course, her freedom is absent, but in its stead, she has no worries.
What can you do when you live in a country where such a thing as slavery is allowed and freedom isn't for everyone? What can you do if a growing number of Americans object to immigration? Considering self a patriot and an immigrant devoted to equal rights and liberty, Friedrich Munch despises these self-declared natives and calls them hateful and selfish. If any Americans were actually natives and not immigrants themselves, the man from Hesse points out in a speech, they would have been the red-skinned hunters who, by the arms of the white man, have been exiled from the country of their birth. Looking back, he writes to the Germans in Missouri.
No law can take away freedom of thought from a man, and as long as one or another thing is not specifically prohibited, the freedom of speech and writing and of behavior are guaranteed to us by the laws of the land. But in reality, we were compelled to live in a state of perpetual guardianship in the hands of slave owners. Not all have felt the same way, because they were not cramped in their daily affairs and were less troubled. But no one else denied the shameful fact that in this so-called free country, we were not free people, but rather had to submit to the whim of the slaveholders. Were we allowed to tell the owners of human beings what we thought of black servitude? Were we allowed to tell the slaves, or even to implicitly indicate by our conduct against them, that we regarded them as human beings and that they had human rights too?
Thoughts are free. Thoughts are free. Who can guess them? They are floating along like the shadows in the night. No man can know them. No hunter can shoot them. It stays as it is. Thoughts are free. Other members of the Giessen Emigration Society, such as the Reform pedagogue Georg Bunsen, from Frankfurt upon Main, or Cornelius Schubert from Dessau, prefer to opt for a state without slavery. Cornelius Schubert, for example, settles in Belleville, Illinois, and in 1847, together with his wife Louisa and others, found a communist commune in Missouri. It doesn't last long, and so the Schuberts move back to Illinois. In 1862, their son, Osfeld, is killed in the Civil War. Among thousands of other German immigrants who fought on the side of the northern states in Missouri were also two of Friedrich Munch's sons. The younger one, Berthold, died in the Battle of Springfield in 1861. He was such a youthful boy, not even 18 years old, a pure, noble, and true mind. Still so young, he wanted to take the opportunity to join his elder brother in battle, Friedrich Munch writes in an article that is published under the title Sacrifice for a Good Cause. And he points out, every one of the millions of souls of traitors which we have in this country is complicit in the spilled blood and the illimitable despair. that immigrants should not transfer their view of the world to their new homeland was vehemently advocated by Georg Troy in his new 1848 guidebook. The author says he had traveled the American continent for a good 20 years, and he tries to convert his compatriots to the American way of life.
The American thinks he is higher, happier, freer, more skillful than the European, and whoever interferes in this prejudice will not get away with it. Anyone who emigrates with the idea of being able to live there as a European is on the wrong path. If he even thinks that he can shine there with his education, spread enlightenment, in short, let his light shine, it will fail in most cases. Furthermore, it cannot be repeated often enough that anyone who wants to go to America has to speak the language there in a finished and unbiased manner in order to get along to some extent. The German language there, like the Irish, is considered a jargon of the meanest rabble.
It is precisely the question of slavery that is explosive.
Already in the southern and western American states, which keep slaves, the contrast between American and European idiosyncrasies is even more obvious. Whoever wants or has to live there is strongly advised to acclimate in every respect. The slavery of the Negroes and half-breeds gives the local way of life a certain immorality. Whatever opinion one may have in this respect, everyone feels that the traveler who stays for a time in slave countries or who seeks his bread there does not have the right to preach his philanthropic principles on the plantations. I have seen such imprudence.
The author from Bamberg was apparently not an ardent supporter of the German social revolution, or sees himself as a diplomat.
What would have been said about this in the good times of feudalism in Germany, if a traveler passing through, or one who was looking for employment, had admonished the hereditary ruler to abolish his concubines and not to abuse the subjects so inhumanely? Suffice is to advise that every foreigner who enters regions where slaves are kept must submit completely to this abomination and, as in Russia against the serfs, observe the customary procedure. If you can't bring such things over your heart, stay away. In an emergency, he must often be able to look at the cruel chastisement as coldly as the planter himself. For if a white man shows pity to a black man, then the black man considers the punishment to be unjust. It is not at all difficult to sow the seed of indignation among these unfortunates. Let no one misunderstand me because I am honestly presenting the matter as it is. I know from experience how dangerous it is to interfere in these sad conditions in countries and on islands where slaves are kept, and to want to play the philanthropist. I warn every young person against such interference.
Georg Troy does not want to come across as an advocate of human trafficking under any circumstances.
Slavery is an unnatural condition. All reasonable slave owners themselves admit this, and very many wish that they could cultivate their plantations with day laborers without slaves. But as soon as they admit this, there are also a lot of harsh, coercive measures and established customs, for example, the separation of social connections according to color, so that a veritable caste system arises, in a way, excused. I have never been a plantation owner. Only individual Negroes I have called mine and have never treated them differently than as one is accustomed to treat free servants. I reckon it fortunately that I have never been put in a position to have to keep a number of these unfortunates.
Nevertheless, he says about the blacks,
the enjoyment of freedom has little appeal for these people at all, because free Negroes are precisely those who suffer the most hardship everywhere. It is true that in Europe as a whole, there is still a very wrong idea of the individuality of Negroes and colored people. There is no more self-indulgent, careless, indolent people than them. And this alone reveals the utter futility of these philanthropic plans. So, if you want to live and get along in those parts, you have to get used to looking at the Negroes from the point of view from which they are usually viewed in those parts, as human beasts of burden, as it were, and unfortunately you get used to it easily.
Friedrich Wunsch does not let threats or advice stop him from taking action against slavery. In November 1864, he and his friend Arnold Krekel from Langenfeld in the Rhineland are elected delegates to the Missouri General Assembly. German radicals like them set the tone here. At the top of the agenda of the constituent meeting in St. Louis is the abolition of slavery. Arnold Krekel signs it on 11 January 1865. Shortly thereafter, as a senator, Friedrich Wunsch introduces a law that makes it possible for blacks to go to school. Arnold Krekel demands that they also be given the right to vote, but that is also too extreme for some radicals. The vote on the Constitution in July 1865 is decided by the soldiers of the Union Army and thus by many German Americans. The plan to create a German model state in the United States, even in a small way, did not work out. The Wunsch family, however, has left many traces in American history, in politics, in viticulture, in the history of the Civil War and the fight against slavery. The documentary Utopia by Peter Roloff, following the traces of the Giessen Emigration Society in Germany and the United States, had its world premiere at the St. Louis International Film Festival in 2014. In Germany, it is a school film by now, a lesson in the history of democracy. More or less in reaction to it, the book The Historic 1830s German Immigration to Missouri was published soon afterwards. Among the authors is the great-great-great-grandson of Friedrich Wunsch, James F. Wunsch, his ancestor, a dedicated follower of philosopher Immanuel Kant, and others of the Giessen Emigration Society, hadn't been looking to build a utopia, he states, but were simply searching for freedom, just like the immigrants of today. Friedrich Wunsch followed Kant's maxim to treat others at all times as you want to be treated yourself, which meant, for example, to fight slavery. In the dialect of Upper Hesse, Wunsch's home region in Germany, the maxim would sound like this, sung to the melody of Go Down, Moses.
Was die Case du soll, das sollste ach käm du, guckte jeden Insen, oh, dann lernst du, was dazu, dann lernst du, was dazu, was dir käis du soll, das sollst du, ach, käm du. Guck dir jeden Einsen o, dann lernst du, was dazu.
Loosely translated, this means, what nobody should do to you, you shan't do to anyone. Have look at each person individually, and you will learn something more. The history of the German immigrants in Missouri is of international interest. In 2019, a graduate research seminar of the universities of Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, St. Louis, and Hamburg led to the book German Migration to Missouri that is online. Descendants of Friedrich Munch have joined forces to form the Munch Family Association. The longtime family's genealogist, Carl Munch, a retired professor of medicine who has died in 2023, had found out that the family Munch not only had sympathies for Lincoln, but is also related to the Roosevelts by marriage. Marie Munch Felonius, the sister of Friedrich and Georg Munch, had 9 children, as did her daughter, Matilda Felonius Lang. Matilda's daughter, Adelheid Lang, has made a name for herself as a cubist sculptor. In 1905, the 26-year-old married the filmmaker Cornelius Louis André Roosevelt, a cousin of Theodore Roosevelt. Lila Roosevelt, Adelheid's daughter, marries the photographer Armand Dennis, with whom she makes films in Africa, among other places.
Little do we know about the women of the Gießen Emigration Society and about so many other female pioneers. Have they even been asked by their husbands or fathers if they wanted to leave their hometowns?
Sisters, it isn't fair how we wish to stay here, but they don't care. We're just giving birth, don't leave a trace on earth. Work is what we deserve here everywhere. Sister in your blue skirt, sister of home, I've heard, we go abroad. Soon we will be at sea for an eternity. No one will think of thee, his story told. Sisters are brothers still, always do have their will, and we do not. We dream of speaking out, also want to be proud, and so let's say it loud, freedom's our lot.
The Missouri German Consortium and others uphold the memory of the early immigrants. The professional genealogist and award-winning author Doris Kievenfranke, for example, has been location manager for the documentary film Utopia and co-author of the book Utopia, Revisiting a German State in America, and part of the international cultural project Traveling Summer Republic. Her passion is sharing local history, also women's history, as she does in her program, Pauline's Diary. Pauline Busch, née Munch, the daughter of Friedrich Munch, and his first wife, who suffered several strokes of fate, has left behind letters and a journal. Her story is similar to thousands of German women who emigrated here in the 19th century, Doris Kievenfranke says. And what has it been like for Luisa Munch, who has just lost her father and 2 of her brothers, and had almost died in postpartum after the birth of her first child, to go on such an arduous journey with a baby? How might it have been for her to start anew in the wilderness, to lose 4 of their 12 children in infancy, their 18-year-old son, Berthold, in the Civil War, to build a farm and provide for a growing family? It needs great imagination to guess how it felt. Well, her husband tried in his guidebook, Derstadt, Missouri, the state of Missouri, that he published for German immigrants in 1859 and presented it on a promotional tour through Germany and Switzerland. It was a book to prepare prospective German immigrants so they might better adjust to the new world after they arrived, the late historian Sigmar Mühl wrote in the Yearbook of German-American Studies of 1998, and Winch's advice was offered mainly to male concerns. One exception occurred in the chapter on country life, Sigmar Mühl stated. Here, he set forth the prospects of the immigrant wife as someone sharing in the experiences of farm living.
A man can be satisfied only if his wife is as well. Many wives, if they have to live in this country, are made uncomfortable, partly by what they left behind, partly by what is demanded of them. Yet the great majority of German wives adjust with a good and ready will to the new situation. Our wives have significant and difficult tasks here. In performing these, they feel important and are never plagued by boredom and are satisfied by what they accomplish for their family. They keep their house clean and orderly, do the cooking, baking, washing, knitting, mending, sewing. Some make men's clothes better than a tailor. Care for the children, milk the cows, make butter, cheese, and soap, dry the fruit, cook jams, prepare fruit and vegetables, tend the flower and kitchen gardens, and the fowl. Indeed, many even weave the necessary fabrics for the household use. Despite all that, wives do not cease to live as cultured human beings. They are the center of the intimate and warm family life.
From 1866, Munch's guidebook is published in Bremen, first by Mühle and the second edition by Hauschild in 1875. 2 decades have passed since the book came out. Farm life has become a bit easier also for women, though they are still not plagued by boredom. The mentioned machines don't run by electricity yet, and every helping hand is needed.
The German housewives usually enjoy very functional ovens, which have a device for frying, baking bread and cakes, and heating larger amounts of water. They are satisfied with the local cookware, washing machines, milking equipment, preserving cans, among other things, and endure that there is always a lot on the table. Good cellars are a real amenity. Even more and more ice houses and bathhouses are being built. Despite some relief, the tasks of the local farmer's wife are not small. Rough work in the fields and the barn is not to be expected of her, but she keeps her house clean and her garden in order, takes care of cooking, washing, sewing, recently with the help of a sewing machine, spinning, wool only, knitting, fruit drying, the poultry and the dairy industry, cooks her soap, feeds the children, and yet is ready in time as, from early on, all the family members help to the best of their ability to cope. Thus, the woman does not become dull or peasant-like, but rather finds the necessary free hours for social recreation. The girls have grown up in their 15th year, and then we rarely keep them longer than a couple of years.
In the emigrant novel, Jørn Jakob Sveen der Amerikafarer, or Jørn Jakob Sveen the American Driver, at least the first-person narrator, a pioneer, does not feel superior to women in his family. The emigrant Carl Vidal from Mecklenburg, who had come to Victor, Iowa with his wife in 1868, kept writing letters to his former teacher. The teacher's son, Johann Gilhoff, made a successful novel out of it in 1917, which was soon read also in Hessian villages. In more than one chapter, the quick-witted wife called Wiesgen and the equally quick-witted daughter have the last word.
Well, now I'm smoking my pipe, and my wife Wiesgen scolds me. The smoke makes their stores look yellowish. Wiesgen, I say, how could the black smoke of my brown pipe make your white curtains yellow? And she says, Jürn Jakob, how is it possible that the black cow of our farmer eats green grass and gives white milk and yellow butter? And my daughter says, how is it possible, Dad, that the brightest flashes come from the darkest clouds? So, I had my answers. Don't mess with that woman, people, really. They are a completely different nation, the ones that have long hair.
A completely different nation, Friedrich Munch of the Gießen Emigration Society sees things a little differently. In 1848, the year of the St. Paul's Church Assembly in Frankfurt am Main, he writes an essay in Missouri on the social position and rights of women. Die Munch Family Association has documented this speech. Let's listen.
They tell us a great deal about emancipation of women, as though she was held by man in an unworthy state of dependence, while in 1,000 instances, our compassion should rather be on the side of man, who seems to need being emancipated not less than his fair and all-powerful complement, but of a full equality of the natural destination of man and women, an equality of their position in life, an equality of their rights and duties. Very few, I guess, have as yet dreamed. Nature has not willed such a thing. The destination of every creature is shown forth by the native properties it was endowed with by its maker. The rights of every human individual are corresponding with certain duties. Now, I do not say that women's destination, position in life, rights, and duties are inferior to those of men, but different, greatly different. This difference extends even to the moral sphere. Tolerance, for instance, although a praiseworthy virtue, can, if carried too far, become blamable feebleness in man under circumstances when women might be still justified, nay, morally obligated, to exercise it. In short, the scene of action for either sex is distinctly marked by nature. Women's greatest perfection can only be manifested in domestic life. Man's in public. Man, of course, ruled by the power of physical strength, prowess, and intelligence. Women reigns by their irresistibility of love, innocence, tact, finesse, delicacy, in short, amiability. And who can say which of both kinds of dominion is stronger or nobler?
Here, the Protestant pastor, ahead of his time in so many ways, but also a child of his time, speaks of the God-ordained order.
Man is not superior to woman, nor is she to man. The truth is, neither of them represents the entire fullness of human perfection, but they are designed to do so by and in their union. They are not equal, but congenial. I must confess that in the course of my life, I never met a woman, virgin, or wife, who seriously wished this natural order of things subverted. The more refined woman is, the more she thinks of the high calling of her own sex, of its duties. I therefore say, a woman should not have a direct voice or hand in the enactment and administration of our laws. She is represented by her father, husband, etc. He is a mean lawgiver who, in the enactment of laws, does not consult the natural rights, honor, and welfare of both sexes equally.
So, no right to vote for women?
I candidly believe that the female half of our population is better represented now in this very republic than a female should make their appearance on the floor of Congress and General Assemblies, or take the presidential chair, etc. Let us be men, real men, and we shall find means to cure all present evils and wants of our public affairs. In fact, this very state we live in is undoubtedly better governed than any other in the world. I know that we still labor under many imperfections. I say with all the firmness of religious conviction, if you truly value the lovely and charming properties of female character, keep your wives and daughters far from these scenes of life which might tend in the least to violate the delicacy of their feelings, the purity of their hearts.
That's how most men in their old homeland keep it. In 1848, the Hessian women are no real citizens. They have no right to vote in the National Assembly of St. Paul's Church, the first all-German parliament. Women are not allowed to participate in the discussion, nor are they allowed to stand for election. What remains for them is to follow the men's debates from the ladies' gallery and interject. They are denied the lectern, the place in a parliament, even until after the First World War. In the 21st century, the American Ruth Stern Gaston, a victim of Nazi persecution and an emigrant from Niederohmen, has mentioned a motto of her life in the epilogue of her biography, An Accidental American.
Democracy is not a spectator sport.
You have been listening to the podcast, Now We Go Overseas, a free production from the Historical Society Lastoria, Bremen, with volunteers from the United States. This was part two, Departure to Freedom, of 500 who set out to find and fight for human rights. Some of them have changed the country they settled in for the better. Written by and final technical editing by Monica Felsing. English version directed by Susan Eldridge. Copyright in Connecticut, United States, and Bremen, Germany, 2023 and 2024. The Historical Society Lastoria wishes to thank every volunteer who participated in this transatlantic project about migration, as well as everyone who has performed the research and published information from which this was written. Our podcast consists of six parts. The original version is in German. the German historian Monika Felsing used AI for initial translations of her manuscript from German to English, which was then revised with help from Susan Eldridge, née Bodenhausen. The English and German parts of the podcast are online in the United States at badmorgen.wordpress.com. That's badmorgen.wordpress.com. In Germany, you can find them at monikafelsing.de. That's monikafelsing.de. The manuscripts and bibliography will be available at a later date. Please don't hesitate to contact us in Germany at mail@lastoria-bremen.de or in the United States at badmoregenealogy@gmail.com.
We would like to thank all the volunteer readers in their order of appearance. The narrator segments were read by Susan Eldridge in America. Susan also read two poems, Brothers, It Can't Go On Like This and Thoughts Are Free. The duo Eigenart from Nidderau, Hesse, performed at the Weidich Weekend in Oberglehn in 2015. The first song from this concert, Brüder, so kann's nicht gehen, was written by Karl Vollen in 1825. The second song played in this podcast was the first stanza of Die Gedanken sind frei, which was also played in full at the end of the podcast. Paul Follenius, Vollen, was read by Hans-Peter Klein from Melsungen in Germany. Friedrich Münch was read by Leslie Krieke in America. Monika Felsing in Germany read the first two parts of Friedrich Münch, including the poem, the parts for Karl Schurz, Maria Follenius, and Gottfried Duden. In addition, Monika sang in the Upper Hessian dialect, the dialect of Münch's Heimat. Ingrid Ruschenski read the poem Here at the Mississippi by Hoffmann von Fallersleben. The role of Cornelius Schubert was read by Lucian McRobbie in America. The role of Georg Dreu was read by Burkhard Bock in Germany. Doris Kieven-Franke in America performed research on the Münch family from Germany and described their experiences in the wilderness of early America through the words of Pauline Münch. Nikki Rittenhouse from America sang the song Sisters. The role of Jürn Jakob Sveen was read by Peter Falting in Germany. Ruth Sterngasten spoke for herself. We will hear more from Ruth in our next podcast.
Our next podcast will be part 3, Zwieback and Captain's Dinner. How a 5-year-old and a 17-year-old from Hesse experienced their first sea voyage and what became of them and others. Copyright, all rights reserved, public performance only with permission from the Historical Society Lastoria, Bremen, Bremen, Germany, and Connecticut, USA, 2023 and 2024.